Good morning. The chief is not going to be with us this morning, but he has read the briefs and will be fully participating in the deliberations of all of the cases. The first case on the calendar is Shiloh Automotive versus William Wilkins. For the appellant, Mr. Steinis.
Good morning, Your Honors. The threshold issue in the case today is whether the Board of Tax Appeals reasonably and lawfully decided that MTD Products' sale of its automotive division to Shiloh Automotive did not qualify as an arm's-length transaction because of the relationship between MTD and Shiloh on the date of sale. The Board of Tax Appeals wrote that while it never found and did not find that Shiloh underpaid for the assets of the automotive division as compared to what would have been paid if the transaction had occurred on the open market, it nevertheless held that the transaction couldn't be viewed as an arm's length because the directors of MTD, all of whom were interested directors of the company, approved the transaction. Now, essentially, they've held that only disinterested directors of a company can participate in the negotiations and approval of a transaction with a company in which the in which there is a significant ownership interest. And that's incorrect as a matter of law, and based on the facts of this case, it's an unreasonable conclusion to draw.
Well, counsel, isn't a more important rationale for the denial was the fact that there was no other purchaser sought in this exchange. It was totally in-house, so to speak.
It was a private sale. It wasn't an open market transaction.
Exactly. And I know that the your brief suggests that the very nature of the business precluded an open market offering, and that the industry was shifting and changing in a way that there was a very limited appeal to this sale.
That's not exactly the point I was trying to make. With regard to the open market standard, it's just a standard. It's not a requirement. In Waters v. Knox, decided by this court in 1989, it's one of the three standards one looks to determine whether or not a transaction is open market or not. Mm-hmm. But it's a standard, not a requirement. In this case, the board didn't hold that this transaction wasn't an arm's length transaction because it wasn't conducted on the open market. Exactly the opposite. They concluded that that's not a requirement, and they've done so in literally scores of cases since 1989. Just backtracking a bit, in Waters v. Knox, there are three factors to characterize a transaction as arm's length. It's got to be voluntarily entered into. That's not a problem in this case. Nobody contends that it is. It generally occurs on the open market, and I've just addressed that. And third, and most important, it's the crux of this case, is that the parties have to act in their own self-interest. Now, with respect to acting in their own self-interest, I think the facts of this case point out, lost my train of thought.
You were talking about self-interest, that they had to act in their own self-interest.
If you view the facts of this case, when the negotiations started out, MTD was asking roughly $50 million for the assets of the automotive division. At that point in time, Shiloh held the view that the assets had a value of maybe $25 million in that price range. After a period of several months of negotiations, MTD persuaded the directors of Shiloh to accept a pricing formula that led to a price of $49.5 million. Now that, I think, points out that MTD was acting in its own self-interest when it negotiated this deal. And I think that's further supported by the fact that an investment banking firm, Baird and Associates blessed the transaction, indicating that the value, the price paid for the assets of the division represented the fair market value of the assets. More importantly, The outside lending institutions that provided MTD with its line of credit, the only line of credit it had, had the ability to, and looked at the assets of the automotive division as collateral for their loans, had the ability to prevent the transaction if they held the view that it was that the assets were being sold for less than fair market value. They didn't do that. They accepted $49.5 million as adequate price for this company and blessed it. Overlooked in this case a lot, too, is the fact that in the record, the auditing agents and the audit supervisor said that they took pains to find in filings with the SEC and other places evidence that this was not an arm's-length transaction, and they couldn't. And they wound up writing in their report that this transaction is an arm's-length transaction for financial reporting purposes. Their only complaint was that it wasn't conducted on the open market, and that's the reason that they viewed it as not arm's-length. And as I've indicated, there is no requirement that a transaction be conducted on the open market. If you
explain to us the implication in terms of the actual taxable values, if we agree with you or if we agree with the state.
Well, under law, it's our position and it's supported by the law, that the price paid in an arm's length transaction sets the value for personal property tax purposes of the property at the point of sale. So that's $49.9 million in the aggregate, a portion of which was attributed to machinery and equipment. That's the starting point.
Right.
And the state.
Don't you have to get down to either an appraisal or a look
no.
at the book value?
No, in Buckeye International, Canalco, and Telemedia, three cases that come to mind decided by this court, the court concluded that the price paid in an arm's length transaction properly apportioned under APB 16 is the best evidence of value, and there's no appraisals in those cases. It's two parties getting together, sorting out what the fair market value of the item being sold happens to be, and once they've agreed, that's the best indication of value there is. It's an actual sale. People paid money.
Well, but you can, it seems to me we have other cases off the top of my head, and maybe they're not comparable, maybe it wasn't personal property. I'm thinking Procter & Gamble. I'm thinking Smucker's, where there were transactions and there was a dispute about how much was assigned to goodwill or to non-taxable things, and so you end up with a dispute as to how much the real machinery that makes a place work should be valued.
That relates to the secondary issues in this case. The first issue is there an arm's length transaction? If
right.
there is, it pegs the price. The second issue is, does APB 16 apply? And it clearly does. It's addressed in the briefs. We've had expert testimony to the effect that it does apply. That brings you to the third issue, which is your issue. How do you apply APB 16? And the rules are pretty straightforward. They're set forth in that accounting standard. And basically what you do is you take all the liquid assets, and like money and investments and things that you can really determine the value of, and you assign that portion of the purchase price to them. Eventually, you get down to whatever amount of cash is left, the portion of the purchase price is left, and you apportion that. In this particular case, the dispute, virtually all the assets had a value that's clearly determinable. The residual amount was then allocated among land and real estate, machinery and equipment, things of that sort. The way you're supposed to do that is based on an appraisal, and then proportionally allocate the residual amount.
And here the tax commissioner treated all of it as new, right?
No, it's not new. And I'll get back to that in a second. Because there was only something like $3 million left to allocate, it was decided that it did make sense to do a full-blown appraisal of all these residual assets, the machinery
equipment. So when you're done with all the takeouts, the machinery is only worth $3
million. That's right.
Out of the 49 million.
Out of the 49.5. And actually, all that machinery and equipment today is out of service. In retrospect, when the question is, was $49.5 million too little to pay, turned out to be way too much. The Parma plant, which had 700 employees, is mothballed. Let me get back to...
Before you get back to something, what I'm concerned about is your suggestion of the arm's length transaction. The commissioner found that the net book value of the assets 6 months before the sale was $77 million.
It's probably true.
The purchase agreement was $49 million, and yet after acquisition, Shiloh listed the total cost of the assets at $37 million. So we're dealing with numbers that at least the board could say, this really wasn't arm's length because the numbers aren't.
They didn't say that. They specifically said the opposite. They said they didn't find that Shiloh underpaid. They simply said we don't view this transaction as arm's length for a reason, and the reason is the interested directors approved it as opposed to the disinterested directors, of which there were none. In terms of the numbers, the book value of the company was much higher than the $49.5 million. That's not surprising because book value reflects nothing more than the purchase price, less depreciation over time, and everybody knows that the property depreciates faster or slower than reality from time to time. This court said often that book value is not an indicator of fair market value. That's the reason it's virtually never employed, even by the Department of Taxation. They use their own true value schedule to
What today. About the due diligence report from Ernst & Young?
What about it?
It wasn't produced and lost, or?
No. To the extent that Shiloh had any of the materials requested by the department, it was provided. They may have asked from time to time for things that were in the hands of MTD, an unrelated party, and just didn't have it to turn over. But anything that was requested was turned over. This was an audit that took about a year and a half. And in the early stages, the department indicated what their position was going to be. The company kept coming back and saying, consider this, consider this, consider this. And it would be considered to one extent or another. And the agents kept coming back and said, no, this isn't an open market transaction. We're not going to accept the amount you paid in this transaction as an indication of value. The board, when you distill all this down, what the board said was that because we're not convinced, because the interested directors approve this deal of MTD, we're not convinced it's open market. And they cited three factors. The first was that MTD's directors were aware of Shiloh's long-term plans. Well, the long-term plans didn't include acquiring the automotive division in the first place. It took 6 months for them to be persuaded to buy that division at any price. More to the point, there's no logical or reasonable inference that anybody can draw, in my view at least, that simply knowing somebody's long-term plans would induce you to or make you more inclined to charge as much as you could for the property you're trying to sell. The premise doesn't follow or lead to the conclusion. The other two factors the board said was that there were informal discussions held prior to the issuance of an offering statement between MTD and Shiloh. All that was in the summer, the preceding summer of the transaction, MTD inquiring as to whether or not Shiloh would be interested in acquiring the division if it were put up for sale. Again, that's not going to lead anybody to higher or lower their price, just simply having that discussion. The third factor was that MTD purportedly tailored its offering memorandum to attract or pique Shiloh's interest. Well, I wouldn't expect anything less. Anybody would do that. They're highlighting in the offering memorandum the factors that would make the acquisition of the division attractive to Shiloh.
Counsel, your argument is all persuasive, but I keep having trouble getting around the notion that talking about these folks as if they're strangers.
They're not.
They're not.
They know each other.
Well, one owns 51% of the other one.
Well, no, close, but
well, that's wrong.
you get to 51% if you throw in the pension trust, which is owned or managed by an independent bank. The people we're talking about, the interested people that have the real ownership interest, represent about 46%.
In many corporations, control is substantially less than 51%.
In this case, I will concede about 46% of the ownership of Shiloh was controlled by people that owned and controlled MTD. But that's an important factor here. If you accept the premise that the interested directors accepted less for the automotive division because they were they had this ownership interest in Shiloh, you're accepting the premise that they voluntarily shifted a significant portion of their wealth to people they didn't know, because every dollar of discount on the purchase price translates into dollars coming out of the pockets of MTD and MTD's owners and going to the other public shareholders of Shiloh. And that nobody would do that. And that's what the board's determination would lead you to conclude. They've cited three factors in one page of their entry. That's the totality of the analysis that they devoted to this issue. And those three factors, if you just consider them and ask yourself, would they lead any reasonable person to be more inclined or inclined to reduce the purchase price of that which they're going to sell? And I'm confident that you would conclude no. I see my time's up.
Thank you. Mr. Hubbard.
May it please the court. The Board of Tax Appeals and the Tax Commissioner reasonably and lawfully held that the November 1999 bulk sale restructuring transaction was not an arm's length transaction. And they reasonably and lawfully held that because of two fundamental factors. One, it was not a sale in the open market. And two, it wasn't between totally self-interested parties. It was between very closely related entities. Justice Pfeiffer mentioned the 51% ownership interest. That was a finding of the tax commissioner in his final determination. It was a finding of the Board of Tax Appeals. It was the figure that was set forth in the proposition of law in Shiloh Automotive's brief filed with this court. And it was only when they filed the reply brief that they mentioned they now were asserting that the interest was 46%. And this court has long held that it's incumbent upon the appellant at the Board of Tax Appeals and their notice of appeal to the board to contest the factual findings of the commissioner. The commissioner made a finding there was a 51% ownership interest. They didn't appeal that in their notice of appeal to the board. The board itself made that same finding. The taxpayer didn't, in its notice of appeal to this court, assert that as error. And after we submit our brief, and after they, in their own statement of facts, say it's a 51% interest, then they come back and say, no, it's really a 46% interest. And then we will look at the record of the testimony at the Board of Tax Appeals. And their own witnesses uniformly said that it was an over 50% interest. The very statements that they cite to as in evidence for the proposition that's 46%, if you look at that page, it's a part of their SEC filings, it says the interest is 51.3%. That's how it characterizes the interest that the parent corporation, MTD, held in Shiloh Industries, the majority-controlled sub, immediately prior to this bulk sale restructuring transaction. So we would submit that this is clearly a situation where there's a majority, where the sub is controlled, 51%, there's a majority control of the sub by the parent corporation, MTD. Now, I would agree with Justice Pfeiffer that even if it weren't a majority interest, a 46% interest is a very substantial interest in and of itself, and they're very related parties. This court, in a long series of cases that we cite in our brief, beginning with In re Sears and Park Investment and proceeding to the current, including one of my favorite personal property tax cases, Graebler Manufacturing, says what an arm's length transaction is. And it recognizes that related party transactions are not at arm's length. This is a particularly easy case for saying that it's not at arm's length because of the degree of the relationship being so great. And it's not simply because the directors are shared.
Well, didn't the board find it was not an arm's length?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and so did the tax commissioner for the very reasons we're saying. I mean, if you look at it, it's very clear that the board said this is not an arm's length transaction. And they cited, like I said, they found that it was a 51% ownership interest and it was not on the open market.
And our determination is limited then to whether or not that decision was reasonable and lawful.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And because it's a factual finding, this court recently in the Strongsville case issued earlier this year said the factor that it's not an open market transaction, that it was purely closed, it was never even offered to send anybody in the public. That factor in itself provides a sufficient basis for affirming the decision that there's no arm's length transaction when the board makes that determination.
So, Mr. Hubbard, just one of the elements of the Knox test, if one of the elements is not satisfied, you would say there's sufficient evidence to say it's not an arm's length transaction?
That's not only me, Your Honor. That's what this court just said in the Strongsville case, citing to Kroger and to the Walters case. And what I would say here, it's a much easier case because we have that coupled with the fact that it's a closer related sale. I mean, the closer related sale in and of itself, if it were corroborated with an open market transaction, still would be invalid. But when it's not corroborated, but even more fun.
Do you agree with me, though, that you can have closely related parties, you can have a transaction that's not at arm's length, but still have a fair market value transaction? You could still have them paying a market value.
Well, it's got to be self-interested, Your Honor. And this court has actually said in cases that were much less closely related that it wasn't arm's length. Park Investment is a perfect case of that.
But they can still negotiate in good faith and still have a fair market value. So assuming that these parties are related and it is not an arm's length, what is the evidence that this was not a fair value for the company?
Thank you, Your Honor. I would say the most probative evidence is when you look at the actual arm's length sales of the machinery and equipment at issue by MTD when it acquired them in the ordinary course of business. For example, and this is in the record in the field audit report done by the agent, and it was cited in the tax commissioner's final determination, so it's clearly evidence in this case. In the 4 years prior to the November 1999 sale, MTD, the parent corporation, acquired in the ordinary course of business, $30.6 million of new equipment. Most of it, according to the agent, he did an on-site review, and this was our top agent in the department, John Nolfi, who's currently the personal property tax administrator. And he did a bang-up job on the audit. It's very comprehensive. And he points out that most of that equipment was comprised of state-of-the-art robotic welders. And it was purchased, like I said, over $30 million worth. Those same assets, together with the earlier acquired machinery equipment, was then valued by Shiloh Automotive as a result of this bulk sale restructuring transaction at only $1.3 million. Initially, it was valued at $3 million, and then they lowered it down even further to $1.3 million. And that's that $1.3 million was treated as the original acquisition cost when they filed the returns. And that's the valuation they're urging that we take. That constitutes a 96% reduction from the net book value.
Counsel, what's the end game here in terms of the status of the value assigned by the tax commissioner and then by the board? And if we agree with your proposition that this is not arm's length, is it over or should it go back for a more proper evaluation of the equipment that was in question?
Your Honor, that's an excellent question, and it's somewhat the subject of our cross appeal. And that what the board said is, first and foremost, that this was an arm's length transaction, and therefore their exclusive reliance on that sale, with no other evidence, no appraisals, no other evidence whatsoever, was not a valid basis to support their valuation. But then they said the commissioner should have used the original acquisition costs of MTD as opposed to the net book value at the time of the November sale. And then to those original acquisition costs of the machinery and equipment as acquired by MTD, those historical acquisition costs, the board said the commissioner shall apply the depreciation rates that are prescribed by the commissioner. And in perhaps an abundance of caution, we move for a clarification at the board to say those prescribed rates are for that industry. Those are Class Life 5 rates for the production machinery and equipment, and Class Life 3, which is a faster schedule for the non-production machinery and equipment. And that was simply following the reasonable and logical consequences of the board's affirmance of the commissioner that this was an arm's length sale. Essentially, what the...
Did they answer that? Did they...
We believe they did in their decision. Oh, when we move for clarification, when we move for clarification of the board's directive upon remand, to amplify it slightly, to just say what the prescribed rates were, before the board could grant consideration of our motion, the notice of appeal was filed by Shiloh. So they didn't address
our amplification. So you would be arguing if you prevail on the arm's length issue, it should go back to the board for clarification of the appropriate depreciation rates. Do you agree with them that the starting point is the original purchase price?
Yeah, certainly agree with that.
And then apply a rate of...
Commissioners prescribe rates. We're simply asking that be set forth. That's the clear important effect of what they said, but because the taxpayer was arguing that you should disregard the historical acquisition costs and instead they're contesting it. So when we realized that in our informal discussions that they were contesting it, I thought it would be appropriate to ask the board just to clarify.
You argue there's three-year-old machinery. Mr. Stein is saying if you go out there today, it's all gone, and implying that much of this was obsolete machinery, though it was 3 years old.
Well, he may have intended today to say that it's, I don't know. That's not on the record. And certainly it wasn't considered by the board what happens in 2007 with respect to evaluation for 2001.
Right.
But I can assure you that the record clearly establishes, and it's totally unrebutted by any testimony at the Board of Tax Appeals, what the agent said in his audit remarks that are part of this record. And it says that this is newly acquired equipment, technologically advanced equipment, consisting of numerous robotic welders and other things like it, that were purchased for $30.6 million over the previous 4 years.
What is the bottom line? And we know the big numbers. What's the bottom line valuation that you're arguing?
Well, the valuation would be to take the original acquisition costs, which totaled about $72 million for the machinery and equipment, and that goes way back, but in, from, say, 19, the first year was probably in the early 90s, to 1999. We're talking about only those assets that were acquired that were MTD assets, not the assets that Shiloh Automotive acquired after the bulk sales date. Okay, so we take that $72 million, Your Honor, I'm sorry, and then we apply the Class Life 5 true value allowances to the production machinery equipment, which was the bulk of that. So, and the rates there go down to like the floor value is 18%.
So what did it lead you to? What was the commissioner, what was the number the commissioner was working with when
The commissioner was using the net book value and using 1999 as the acquisition date, whereas in the net book value of these was $30 million, all right? $30.9 million, almost $31 million. So that's what the commissioner used as a starting point. And then the commissioner the commissioner treated it as a 1999 acquisition, all right, and then applied a depreciation from that period forward. What the board's saying is you don't use the $30.9 million, you use the $72 million, but you go back to the years in which the MTD acquired the assets, so there would be greater depreciation.
You don't know the bottom line number.
The bottom line can be derived by the figures we attach to our appendix. I mean, it's a straightforward mathematical calculation. I haven't done that calculation, but it's going to be, around what the previous one was. It could be higher or lower, but it's going to be around what the commissioner already assessed.
If this was a business that is falling out of bed, is it possible that the motivation, say it's not arm's length, but the motivation is to get it off the books and on down so that for Wall Street, the seller looks better and the seller is eating some of what they know is the real world diminution in value, and going to let the subsidiary eat the rest.
Your Honor, if that were the case under generally accepted accounting principles, there are many ways. That's called an impairment of value of the assets. And you establish that by doing a cash flow analysis and doing appraisals and that kind of thing. They didn't do any of that. They didn't do any appraisals. Mr. Sinus says that what they did, it was in accordance with GAAP, but actually using in a close related transaction like this where there's a majority controlled subsidiary involved, it's a violation of generally accepted accounting principles in Securities and Exchange Commission financial statement disclosure rules to use the non-arm's length transaction, this closely related transaction. That's what they did, and that violated generally accepted accounting principles in the SEC rules. But there is a valid way for doing it. You establish through appraisals and through cash flow analysis and other things that you have an impairment of assets, and companies do that all the time. If you look at an SEC report for lots of companies, even if they have good assets, they may have assets that are impaired. That is that their carrying value or the net book value overstates their fair market value. That happens all the time. They didn't do that. Instead, they created this corporate restructuring, didn't do any appraisals, didn't do any analysis, and it's absurd on its face. I mean, when you have a net book value of $30 million of assets that are new assets, and suddenly now they're $1.3 million. And as you pointed out, part of that problem is the allocation of the purchase price. It's not just the starting point, what the purchase price is, it's that allocation. And they allocated all the value of all the purchase price to the exempt assets, the current assets, nothing, almost virtually nothing, to the taxable assets. I mean, in this court, we cited in our brief several border real property valuation cases where this court has questioned that approach, you know, where it's in their interest to allocate it all the exempt, obviously, and that's what they did.
Mr. Hubbard, what is the relief you're seeking on your cross appeal?
What we're asking is for a clarification, for this court to bless the clarification we said, either because that's what the board said, and that's the clear import that they said, or alternatively, that's a reasonable.
Did you say bless the clarification?
Yeah. We set forth on our cross appeal what we believe the board's directive was intended to do, and we would ask the court to adopt that. And for one or two alternative reasons. One, that's what the board said. And two, it's reasonable and lawful in any event. It's the natural consequence of the evidence and what the board held, that this was an arm's length transaction. Essentially, what we're asking for is that this transaction be ignored for purposes of valuation, which is because it's not an arm's length transaction. It's not probative evidence. And so then you use the predecessor's values. That's all we're saying. We're treating it the same as if there were never any transaction. These assets were still held by MTD.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hubbard. On behalf of the court, it's nice to know that a tax lawyer has a favorite personal property case.
I have several.
It also implies you have a couple that aren't your favorite. So
I have some of those, too.
Thank you. Mr. Steinitz.
I'll be brief. There are a number of factual assertions that I just heard that I quarrel with. I don't have time to address each and every one, so I'm not going to even start. I want to leave you with this reminder. The issue in this case boils down to whether or not the transaction we've been talking about was conducted at arm's length. The Board of Tax Appeals says it was not for a specific set of reasons. It's because the interested directors of MTD negotiated and approved the deal, and they cited three factors. If you look at those three factors, accept them for what they are. I'm not asking you to reweigh them or change them in any respect. Just look at them and ask yourself, do these establish that MTD would be more inclined at all to reduce the purchase price, the asking price for the automotive division? And if you conclude that they do not, then I think you have to conclude that the board's decision is unreasonable and unlawful. All this other dialogue about how the numbers play out, you know, there's a response to every statement that Mr. Hubbard made. And we could be here for an hour discussing the ins and outs. But the legal issue is the board's decision reasonable and unlawful based on the facts that it decided? And there's only three, and they appear on one page of the opinion.
What response do you interpose for the cross appeal?
You know, I think it's premature. The Board of Tax Appeals said that this was not an arm's-length transaction.
Yes.
They established the base price for the year of acquisition. And the issue becomes, what do you do in later years? How quickly do you depreciate the assets? And we advanced an argument before the board that's based on an interoffice communication issued by the Department of Taxation and said, this is the way you ought to be doing things. And without getting into, yes, we agree with that specific methodology, that they agreed with the proposition that accelerated depreciation is appropriate because this is old property we're talking about, not new property. And the cross appeal says, well, do it a specific way. And my response to that is, it's on remand back to the Department of Taxation. Do it the way you think is appropriate, interpreting the Board of Tax Appeals' final decision. And if we think you're wrong, we'll appeal. If we think you're right, we won't. But you know, to ask this court to weigh in and interpret what the board meant on that issue, I think is a waste of your time.
Thank you, Mr. Steinitz.
Thank you.
The case is submitted.